You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 8th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Ale Press, author of Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Rules, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Breaking Ranks, Pardon Me. Also on the program today, Jay Tomlinson from the Best of the Left podcast will be talking about Our Blue Media. That and Mitt Romney just, digging himself a hole. We may not have to talk about this election after today. I mean, or yesterday, or tomorrow, or ever. But we probably will. We'll get to that story where a right-wing think tank wants to make it clear you are just like the Unabomber. If you believe in science. And speaking of science, Republicans continue to wage their war on light bulbs. Not joking. And the UC Davis dozen, looking at extensive prison time and fines for effectively protesting a bank on their campus. All right, folks, I'm not going to lie to you. I have a pretty bad cold, and I don't feel well. And you will pay because of it. We may have a shorter show today. I'm not sure. That's the beauty of doing a podcast. One of the downsides is that you have to ask people to become members at majority.fm. Right now, the interview I did with Russ Feingold last week, getting a little play online. I mean, all of our programs do well. Some make news. Russ Feingold interview making a little bit of news. You know that shortly after that interview, Progressives United came out slamming Nancy Pelosi on her public pronouncements that she would accept a Simpson-Bowles plan, basically to cut Social Security. And Progressives United came out hard against her, and that was good to see. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Ale Press on his book entitled Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. One of the things I saw last night, it was actually one of the best segments I've seen on TV in a long time. It looks like they shot it on a cable access set, but that's not the relevant part. Elliot Spitzer interviewed William Binney, Kirk Beebe, and Thomas Drake, three different whistleblowers who blew the whistle on two different NSA programs. One was the, well, they both obviously involved spying on American citizens. It is unbelievable. I don't know if they're able to put that segment online. In fact, I doubt that they are. And I should have recorded it. But nevertheless, there were two segments, and they really, hopefully somebody will put them up on YouTube, because not only is it disturbing to hear what they blew the whistle on, it is stunning how the American government has launched a full-scale attack on these men. Just incredibly, it's stunning. Thomas Drake was the number three, I think, at the NSA. And they went through the proper processes, proper channels, and reporting what they saw as significant lawbreaking by the NSA. And by the end of it, at least one of these guys, I think it was William Binney, had FBI agents break down the doors of his house. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to AL Press on just what it takes to whistleblow, to stand up against atrocities. A fascinating book. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. AL Press. He is a reporter who contributes to The Nation, New York Times Review of Books, and has recently authored Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Welcome to the program, AL.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks for having me on.
A fascinating book. You interviewed, interviewed is I think, a bit of an understatement. You profile four people in your book who all had sort of very unique circumstances in which, how would you describe what they did? Bucked the
well,
go ahead.
Yeah. Basically they're nonconformists. They're people who, say no, in, as you say, four different circumstances, ranging from, I think, a pretty familiar case, familiar in the sense that there's a lot been written about. I start with a man who disobeyed orders when the lives of Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi Germany were at stake. That's the more familiar case just because there's a whole literature around how so many people conformed in that era and how that sort of greased the wheels for the Holocaust to happen. But I then move forward in time and in a sense closer to home. And by the end of the book, I'm writing about a broker in the United States who says no to greed and apathy and refuses to just, you know, go along with selling a product she thinks is being misleadingly advertised. and she ends up blowing the whistle on a huge financial fraud, that was the fraud at Stanford Financial in Texas. So the book is kind of trying to take this this notion of resistance or refusing from the inside and bring it, you know, from very extreme situations to the more prosaic situations that, that come up in our own lives.
And you also spoke to a man who, a Serbian who was saving Croats from being massacred during the 90s in the wars that in the former Yugoslavia. And
right.
And also an Israeli soldier who essentially decided that he was not going to patrol the Palestinian occupied territories. Tell us that. Tell us about that story.
The Israeli.
Yes.
Sure. There's a soldier profile in the book named Avner Wishnitzer, and he grew up on a kibbutz in a very patriotic family and context. He was a little bit weak, skinny guy in his teenage years, and feared that he would not be able to serve in the army in the way that he kind of dreamed of serving to defend his country. But he becomes, he develops a hobby. He becomes a taekwondo black belt and builds his sort of physical strength and ends up landing in the most select unit of all in the Israeli army called Sayeret Matkal, which is kind of like the Delta Force here, I guess. And he served in that unit for 3.5 years. And then when he got out of the army, he was still on reserve duty. His sister invited him to a lecture. And at the lecture, he saw slides of Palestinians in an area of the West Bank who were having their land burned, trees cut down, all kinds of harassment from Jewish settlers. And this guy, Avner, he really didn't serve much in the West Bank, in fact, at all, because he was in this very elite unit. They weren't sort of doing the day-to-day patrolling that goes on in the West Bank. But he was so disturbed by what he saw in these slides that he decided he had to go there himself. And he goes with some activists. He actually felt very uncomfortable because he wasn't an activist himself. He thought of himself as a soldier.
In fact, this is where the title of the book comes from. In
that's right.
But go ahead, tell the story, and then we'll get to that part because that to me is fascinating.
Yeah, you're right. It does come from that. But basically, he's very uncomfortable, and at a certain point, the convoy of the convoy he's in is bringing blankets to Palestinians living in this area, and at a certain point they come to a part of the road where settlers and then Israeli police have blocked it, and they say you can't go forward. And Avner, being this sort of law-abiding soldier, thinks, well, we should turn around. We shouldn't break the law here. But the activists sort of push on and do go through, and in Avner's mind, of course, he's also thinking, wait a minute, why are we not allowed to bring people blankets? Why is that against the law? So it's the first kind of glimmer of doubt, and he goes there and for the first time in his life speaks to Palestinians, and then gradually has an awakening and decides that that what the army is defending in the West Bank is not Israel's security, but a system that he feels is fundamentally unjust and undemocratic. And if you want, I can explain that the title of the book indeed
Please.
Does come from. Yeah, so Avner, you know, on another trip to the West Bank, he goes to a village where he's heard that hundreds of olive trees have been just cut down and destroyed by settlers who do this because they can get away with it, because they want the Palestinians living there to leave so that the land will be free for Jewish settlers only. Well, Avner goes to this area of the West Bank, and once again,
we should just contextualize, you know, olive trees are the significance of olive trees in that in those towns is is more than I think we might anticipate or expect
in this country. It's the source of livelihood for farmers, for Palestinian farmers living in the West Bank. It's also of enormous meaning to people. And actually, Avner very much understood that because he grew up on a kibbutz, and their main source of income was agriculture. So he spent his childhood, if he wasn't in school, he was gathering oranges in the orange groves or pruning trees. And so he very much understood why this was not a small matter. So he goes to this area of the West Bank, and he's not, and once again, there are Israeli soldiers blocking access, saying, you cannot enter this. This is a closed military zone. And he goes up to one of the soldiers who's blocking him, and he's looking right at him, and he thinks, you know, don't you realize I'm just like you. I'm just a soldier like you. But don't you see that something deeply wrong is going on here? You know, I'm a soldier. I'm not some Yafe Nefesh. And that's the thought that goes through his head. And that's what he told me. And Yafe Nefesh in Hebrew is the phrase for beautiful souls. And when we hear that term, we think, well, why wouldn't you want to be called a beautiful soul? Well, in Israel, being called a Yafe Nefesh is kind of like being called a bleeding heart. Even worse than that, it connotes this kind of very naive person who never wants to get his hands dirty in the real world and has this kind of puritanical, soft attitude. And Avner at first recoils from this term. I think today, you know, he has a different view. He's become a refusenik. He will not serve in the territories. And I think he would say that, he's come to terms with the idea that when you're faced with something wrong, it's not naive, to let yourself see clearly that you shouldn't participate in it. So that kind of tension that exists in his story plays out in all the other stories in the book as well.
And so what is it that brings these types of people together? Because, you know, when you write about the Serb, this was not a guy who I think at first blush would appear to be someone who would do something heroic. I mean, not because they were sort of, and not in the sense that, well, this is a very quiet person. No, the guy just he seems like a guy who would be driving in from Jersey one night to party, in New York City. I mean,
Well, you're right, and one of the. To me, important things about the book is that, about the characters in the book, is that they are not saints. This is not a profile of four Mahatma Gandhis. And I think that's important because I actually think my characters are more typical of people who take stands than the Gandhis. There aren't that many Gandhis or Martin Luther Kings out there. But there are a lot of people who have a basic sense of humanity and who are capable of displaying moral courage. Now, why does this guy, this Serb, why does that soldier, why do they do it? Come away with two things. The first one is that in every story in the book, the characters end up defying the climate of opinion around them, mm-hmm. which tells them that the person on the other side of that fence or on the other side of that wall or on the other side of that war is inhuman and is your enemy, and you have to fight them. You can't make room, you can't make space in your you can't extend empathy to them. And the characters in the book all defy that very bravely. They all sort of come to a moment, and often it's not because they had, the perfect education or ideology beforehand. It's often because they came face to face with the facts, with the reality. You know, Avner goes to this place in the West Bank, and he doesn't see terrorists trying to blow up cafes, which is what the Israeli media is full of stories like that every day. What he sees are farmers who are being harassed and mistreated. And he was, is fluent in Arabic, and he spoke to them. And that first experience sort of jarred everything loose. So one lesson in the book really is that, you know, it's much easier to be cruel and to accept those labels for the other when you're distant from them. And this is very much a lesson that, that applies, I think, here in America. You know, we fight these distant wars against a faceless enemy. And I think that too often we don't come face to face with who it is on the receiving end of a drone or attack or, you know, whatever we may be speaking of. So in the book, the resistance is often sparked by these kind of face-to-face interactions.
What sparked Layla? Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You're saying the other point.
Well, the other point is that very often, you know, these people were not they're almost radicals in spite of themselves, and they're not people who they are all. One of them even says this about himself. They're all, in a sense, true believers. They really believe in the ideals of the system they've joined. In Avner's case, he really believes the Israeli army is the most moral army in the world, and he cannot square that claim and those that principle with what he sees going on in the West Bank.
Does he continue to believe that? I mean, does he continue to believe that after that point? Or is it that intersection when you have that cognitive dissonance? I'm part of the most moral outfit, you know, or what I do is correct. And then I see just sort of evidence I can't ignore. And then it changes the whole worldview? Or is it to bring what that evidence, that problem, back into conformity with their prior version? In other words, which bends? Which breaks?
I think the worldview for Avner, the worldview broke. So I think every character in the book undergoes deep disillusionment because they are these true believers, and then they see something that is absolutely contrary to what they thought, and so they go through a sort of shock and a period of extreme disillusionment. But not all of them develop a whole new worldview. Avner does. He actually goes on to become one of the founders of a really amazing group called Combatants for Peace, which consists of Israelis and Palestinians, ex-fighters who have put their guns down and are trying to fight for a just solution. You mentioned Layla Weidler, the whistleblower I portray. You know, she doesn't, and I think often people don't go all the way in kind of letting go of everything they believed.
In Layla Weidler's case, I mean, her firm was actually sort of actively engaged in almost explicit fraud, as opposed to someone who might be, let's say, an investment banker who was sort of engaged in the sort of less, I mean, in my opinion, it was explicit fraud, but, you know, this is what we do. We bundle a product and then we short it because we know it's junk, but, you know, caveat emptor.
Right.
I mean, I guess because we don't have too much time. I know you've got to get somewhere, but is it when we look at the lack of people in the highest echelons of our government who refuse to take a moral stand, for instance, when they find out, and I'm thinking guys like, you know, Larry Wilkinson and Colin Powell, who, you know, surely they must have known that they, if I take them at face value, that they were basically lied to as well before they made that presentation to the UN, which they now describe as the worst day of their careers or their lives. Surely they must have known at one point after that they had been lied to. And they could have resigned, or surely there were guys on Wall Street who knew that they were selling junk. We've seen the proof of that. Surely we knew it with Enron. Is it possible that, I mean, when you talk about that, what is necessary for someone to actually stand up is to actually start with some type of idealism about their pursuit, as opposed to maybe the cynicism that is baked into a Colin Powell, to an investment banker who already says, like, yeah, I know, you know, I entered into this profession knowing that it was, you know, 1/8 corrupt.
Yep. No, I think you're right. I think that you know, in Layla Wiedler's case, she's not cynical. She doesn't go into the financial world cynical about it. She's an immigrant from El Salvador who makes her way through the system and lands a great job, or what she thought was a great job, as a broker. She's supporting two kids, and she has a completely idealized vision of American capitalism, one that I don't share, but that she believed right up to the day that she finally got a call from the SEC saying, hey, we want to talk to you about this former employer of yours named Stanford, and it turned out that everything she warned of in 2003, that they were engaging in fraud, turned out to be true, and they were indeed, it was a $7 billion Ponzi scheme by then. But I think you're right about two things about the Colin Powell example that are important. I want to make it very clear that, you know, because the book is really about choice and people assuming moral responsibility. I think it's possible, it's more possible than we think, for individuals at all levels of institutions to do that. But of course, there is always a price to pay, and the price is greatest for those at the bottom of the hierarchy, the rank and file soldier, the low ranking worker, the, you know, the rookie on the team. Those with the prestigious titles and the good salaries and the plush positions have a lot more room to maneuver. And therefore they bear more responsibility. So I think that, we should always have that in mind when we think about these kinds of moral dilemmas. At the same time, I do think that we are too quick to assume that there was only one thing one could have done, namely go along or fall silent. And that's simply not true, because in every case, if you look at, you know, all the financial crises we're learning about and reading about now, there were people on the inside who spoke out. Too often, unfortunately, nobody listened to them.
Right. And, you know, I just saw an interview last night with three former NSA agents who were all whistleblowers.
Yes.
And now are subjected to just incredible attacks by the U.S. government. I mean, both legal and, you know, sort of FBI agents busting down their doors. And
yes,
it's, I mean, these are guys who clearly were, and they all have that profile of which you speak. They were incredibly idealistic about what their endeavor was. And so they held the standards to which the NSA was supposed to operate to the highest level.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that, you know, what is going on with them, and unfortunately often in the financial world as well, America has, and Americans have, almost a love-hate relationship to these people, I would say, to whistleblowers, to people who take principled stands. On the one hand, we romanticize them. You know, they're kind of modern-day Thoreauvian characters who speak out and do something, you know, the individual acting against the corrupt government institution or private institution. That plays very much to our deep belief, I think, in individual responsibility and so forth. On the other hand, when people actually do it, and power is threatened, and wealth is threatened, all too often they get persecuted or ostracized or fired. And so I hope that people who read my book try to you know, think about why make that love-hate a little more defensible and consistent by, you know, if we really care and appreciate those who have the courage to stand up, we owe it to them to treat them better as a society.
I'm struck by the, the sort of the establishment liberal response to Bradley Manning versus Daniel Ellsberg. I focus only on the liberal establishment simply because I want to take that notion of the sort of the knee-jerk right response to anything that in some way encroaches upon our military. But, you know, I think the same people who were, or at least today, lionized Daniel Ellsberg are very quick to say Bradley Manning, maybe his treatment's been a little severe, but he should be locked up. How do you account for something like that?
Well, I think it's very It's very, it fits the norm of what I learned in writing the book, unfortunately, which is that those who break ranks in whatever culture, even in democratic societies, they it's easy to admire them from a distance after the fact. It's very difficult to even listen to them, much less admire them when they are right next to you in your workplace or in your government agency you happen to be working in, or in, you know, questioning the things that, that in a sense bind our society together. And so it's not surprising that there's no question that that Ellsberg was not just a more controversial figure, I would say by many a hated figure. You know, back in the 1970s, and that's because the issues relating to the Pentagon Papers and what was going on at the time were so many people were invested in that. Now today, very few people are. You know, it's very easy to look right back and say, "Oh yes, you know, the Vietnam War. What a terrible misadventure that was." And no one's really very few reputations are on the line. But when you bring things up to date, and you talk about, you know, torture, or you talk about the Iraq War, or you talk about various policies that have been implemented in recent years, look no further than Daniel Davis, the lieutenant colonel who has spoken out about Afghanistan and how mm-hmm. the war is being fundamentally misrepresented. Well, then it becomes much less comfortable to listen to the message and to admire the messenger. So the easier thing to do is to say, well, this person must just be a rat or a traitor or whatever those common, you know, dismissive terms that we have for individuals who bring inconvenient truths to light.
AL Press, author of Beautiful Souls, Saying No to Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. We'll put a link up at majority.fm to your book, and love to have you back on to talk more about this. It's just a fascinating subject, and thank you so
thank
much.
Thank you, Sam. Very much enjoyed it. Hope I can come back and talk about it more.
Great.
It'll stay in the news, that's for sure. Okay,
yeah,
take care.
Indeed. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Jay Tomlinson of Fast to the Left.
Oh,
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is my pleasure to welcome to the program Jay Tomlinson of the Best of the Left podcast. Jay, welcome to the program.
Absolutely, and it is my pleasure to be here. Thanks, Sam.
First off, let me just say before we talk about Our Blue Media, I just want to tell people that when you were incredible, and you have been incredibly generous and gracious and helpful in the launch of my podcast, and also, frankly, I know that you have been with many other left-wing progressive independent podcasts and daily shows, and so I want to thank you right off the bat for that.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm you know, Best of the Left, it puts me in a unique position of being able to do well by doing good, and I succeed as the entire community succeeds, so it's selfish altruism.
Well, that's at least that's what the libertarians tell us. We're the best. If you've never heard Best of the Left podcast, obviously it's a compilation of the best of the left from that week.
That's how it's got its name.
Indeed. You were very smart with the marketing on that.
Oh, thank you.
All right. So tell us about Our Blue Media. What is this going to be? I mean, I know we have talked about it a little bit, but I'm usually sort of too frenetic to fully grasp what it is. What is this platform going to be?
Sure. Well, let me tell you how it got started. Basically, looking at it from the listeners and supporters' point of view, I and you, because I know you were like copied on the emails, and several other colleagues of ours who do these shows who have membership programs, we started receiving emails on a semi-regular basis from people saying, hey, I love what you guys are doing. I love that I can support you regularly and directly. But it's gotten to the point where so many of you guys have these membership programs, that I love supporting you, but it's becoming sort of a hassle, and I'm wondering if there isn't an easier way for me to be able to do that. So they would say, I'm managing too many payments a month, or wouldn't it be cool if I could just send one payment and then have it divided up the way I want, among the shows that I want to support. And then, that could lead to really interesting things like, hey, if I'm supporting five shows a month, I don't know, maybe you guys would want to give me like a discount on the membership content, something like that. And so, if you did it, if you teamed up, then maybe you could offer discounts if you felt like it. And the bottom line is, if you made it easier, someone like me would appreciate it. Someone who's paying for like five different shows, they would appreciate it. But if we made it easier, it would also maybe lower the bar to entry for other people who aren't already supporting, who would say, oh, you know what, like this is so easy now. Yeah, like if I don't have to use PayPal and, it's a one-stop shop and I can support all my favorite media, then that's what I'm going to do. And so that is exactly the fundamental idea behind Our Blue Media, which really came from, ideas of listeners who wanted to support Blue Media.
And so you guys are you're building this platform, and you need a little help doing it.
Yeah, exactly. So, the philosophy behind the site is one of the most fundamental progressive philosophies there is that, when we work together, we are stronger because of it. And so following with that philosophy, we thought, people are not only going to love this idea when they hear about it, but they're going to want to help make it a reality. They're going to want to support it. And, so developing a website like this isn't super cheap. So we're looking to raise $15,000. And we just launched the fundraiser on the 1st of May. It was co-launched between Best of the Left, The David Pakman Show, and The Young Turks. And now, about 7 days later, we launched it late on May 1st. 7 or 8 days later, we've raised over $7,000 from over 70 people, meaning people are being incredibly generous, giving an average of about $100 each to help make this a reality. And yeah, so that's what's going on. Ourbluemedia.com or .org or .net all go to the same place, and they all redirect directly to the fundraising page, which will allow people to support directly. And then, you know, again, following on that idea of working together, we're actually going to build a page on the site that features the names of all the people who helped make it happen to show, you know, behind the scenes, like, this is not some corporate entity who's trying to make money off of progressive media. This is the progressive media and the community that surrounds it that have built this themselves to serve, you know, our own needs.
Great. All right. Well, you can we will have a link up at majority.fm. It's Our Blue Media. You're very smart about this. You got all the dots, .com, .org, .net.
We're all about making, you know, our mantra for this whole thing is to make things simple and easy. You know, that it's just like taxes. You know, if you want people to do something less, you tax it more. If you want people to do something more, you tax it less. If you want people to support independent progressive media more, you make it easier. If you want to have people support progressive independent media less, then you tell them that they have to use PayPal. You know, that's just how it works.
Yes, unfortunately. For this program, you have to use PayPal. Although, I mean, if you email us, we'll work something out. But hopefully that won't be a problem in the near future as we get Our Blue Media built up. Jay, thank you so much for coming on and telling us about it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right. All right, folks. Boop, bloop.
Putting down shows that force people to use PayPal.
That's wrong. We still need your memberships now. Don't know what the timeline is for Our Blue Media. And like I said the other day, not sure how we will fit in there. But I do believe that, I do have a tremendous amount of faith in Jay and Pac-Man and the Young Turks. So certainly, if you're inclined, please head over to majority.fm and then click through to Our Blue Media. But if you're not a member of this program, please become one now at majority.fm. All right, folks. In the better half of this program, Romney taking credit for the bailout. Of course he is. And actually big enough to admit that the president should not be tried for treason. Why people who believe in global warming are just like terrorists. And how we are waging a war on light bulbs in this country. All that and more. In the better half of the program today. The number 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can Skype me at Majority Live. See you in the better half.